longer be the majority, and that in fact the configuration that we've known for all of American history would be changing. And that has an impact on everyone in the hierarchy, everyone in the country, everyone in society, to try to figure out how do we work toward a space in which everyone can feel seen and feel that they are recognized as citizens in this country.
Well, Isabel Wilkerson, we're going to do part two of this interview of this incredible book, Cast, The Origins of Our Discontents. Isabel Wilkerson, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and winner of the National Humanities Medal. Part two coming up at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
Does your employer have a matching gifts program? Many companies offer dollar-for-dollar matching charitable contributions for donations you make to KBOO. The impact of your gift may be doubled or possibly tripled. Participating companies also match gifts made by retirees and/or spouses. Matching gifts are a great way for you to maximize your membership dollars. Check with your company's human resources or accounting departments to find out if your employer matches charitable contributions, then request a matching gift form. For more information on companies making matching gifts, go to kboo.fm/employer matching.
KBOO is holding a training this Saturday, August 15th, for KBOO volunteers interested in covering protests in our city for the KBOO Evening News. The training will be virtual, as the station remains closed due to the ongoing pandemic. If you are interested in learning how to cover protests as a KBOO street reporter, contact our news director by emailing newsdirector@kboo.org. That email is newsdirector@kboo.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, police remained mostly peaceful at yesterday's protest, marking the 76th night of Portland's demonstrations against police brutality. Dan Ryan will join City Council to complete the rest of Nick Fish's term, and Minnesota Representative Ilhan Omar's landslide win in yesterday's primary. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 12th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. The Oregon Health Authority reported 258 new cases of COVID-19 on Tuesday, bringing the total number of cases in the state up to 22,022. 7 new deaths were reported, bringing the death toll in Oregon up to 375. A recent study has proven that the virus can linger in the air as an aerosol. The study was done in a hospital, and it found that the live virus could be lingering in the air at distances up to 16 feet away from infected patients. The information could have serious implications for the upcoming reopening of schools across the country. A recent report from the American Academy of Pediatrics found that there has been a 90% increase in pediatric cases over 4 weeks. At least 340,000 children have tested positive for coronavirus, representing nearly 10% of all cases in the U.S. Many experts warn that the Trump administration's new coronavirus database is placing a heavy burden on hospitals and will have, quote, serious consequences on data integrity. On Tuesday, the U.S. reported over 53,000 new cases and at least 1,450 deaths. Nationally, more than 5.1 million people in the United States have been infected with COVID-19, and more than 165,000 people have died. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 20 million people in nearly every country. As of Wednesday afternoon, at least 744,500 people across the world have died from COVID-19. At Portland's city council meeting this morning, the council passed an historic resolution overturning decades of discriminatory housing policies in the city. The Residential Infill Project will address the so-called missing middle problem in Portland housing. This refers to the fact that for decades, Portland has had a ban on duplexes, triplexes, and fourplexes in most of the city's neighborhoods. It was a 3-to-1 vote, with Amanda Fritz casting the dissenting vote. Fritz said that this was the saddest vote she had to cast as a council member. She voted against the residential infill plan because she said it will significantly increase carbon emissions in the city of Portland. Here is Commissioner Udaly, followed by Commissioner Fritz, on why they respectively support and oppose the plan.
The Residential Infill Project, or RIP, has been in the works for years, long before I took my seat on City Council. In its years of development, RIP has become a zoning lightning rod, and it's pitted Portland's affordable housing advocates against people who are concerned with neighborhood character and preservation. This conversation is complex, and it's been challenging. When the Supreme Court ruled about 100 years ago that it was unconstitutional to prevent the sale of property to an individual based on race, we saw zoning codes proliferate across the country, and income became a proxy for race. Because by setting the entry price so high, communities were able to exclude certain types of housing and certain people. So I think that is a vitally important part of the conversation that BPS did a great job detailing in their presentation to us about the racist origins of zoning.
I understand my colleagues' desire to be seen to be doing something to provide more housing for Portlanders. There is no recognition in this ordinance that in the 8 years previous councils worked on the Portland plan and the comprehensive plan, the council added capacity for 49,000 new homes. We have plenty of zoned capacity for new development, all planned lot by lot to add housing where the new residents will have access to transit, services, jobs, sidewalks, and other amenities that make urban living joyful. The comprehensive plan and map adopted after work by Mayors Adams and Hales, Commissioner Fish and me with others, has capacity for 249,000 new homes. This council is voting for changes that throw out 40 years of land use planning in Portland by adding more density without regard for access to transit and services. Our planet is on fire. There is no more important issue at stake in this vote. Putting new homes where they will never have transit, never have sidewalks, never be close to jobs and services will mean that we won't be able to meet the climate emergency goals we all voted for just a few weeks ago. I live 8 miles from downtown. My neighborhood will have capacity for hundreds of new homes in this plan. Absent adequate sidewalk and transportation infrastructure, new residents will have to drive to groceries, jobs, schools, and services. While I welcome new neighbors, I don't want them in full on those terms.
Today's vote came a year after the Oregon legislature passed a bill requiring cities with populations over 25,000 to allow the construction of duplexes, triplexes, and fourplexes on land zoned for single-family housing. The plan has been 4 years in the making and is expected to add around 5,000 new housing units in Portland over the next 20 years. Also at today's city council meeting in Portland, the council voted to condemn the federal intervention in the city. The proposal included an amendment that allowed for continuing communication between Portland police and federal officers. This addition led Commissioner Joanne Hardesty to vote against it because she said she still cannot trust the Portland police to be the ones in charge of that communication. Here's an exchange between Commissioner Hardesty and Mayor Ted Wheeler.
Mayor, you and I can disagree about whether or not Portland police are the appropriate liaison with the feds in Portland. But I will say that this resolution changed in a way that I cannot support, and for the reasons I've stated. Now, you're saying that this is what has to happen. I'm telling you, it is not what has to happen.
Well, I just don't see the need to pay somebody else to do, you know, basically be telephone operators. I think we can trust our folks to be able to do that.
I don't agree with that, Mayor. And let me just say that if we could, we would not still have people in the street every single night. You would not have your police officers declaring a riot every single night. So I fundamentally disagree that the trust is there between the community and Portland police and the feds. And I'm not sure that all the feds are gone, right? We don't know whether they're gone or not. And I don't want to take that chance by allowing Portland police to continue to engage with the federal government, because we've seen what happens on the ground when that happens. So we can fundamentally disagree, and I'm okay with that. Won't be the first time or the last time you and I disagree.
I suspect you're absolutely right.
Despite the opposition from Commissioner Hardesty, the measure passed in the city council vote today. Protests against police brutality and systemic racism continued in Portland for the 76th consecutive night on Tuesday. Several hundred people gathered at Laurelhurst Park in East Portland, then marched to the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. People danced, drummed on various improvised percussive instruments, and chanted together. Not many police were stationed outside the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, and the night remained peaceful. Dan Ryan, who is the former director of the nonprofit All Hands Raise, has defeated former Multnomah County Commissioner Loretta Smith in yesterday's special election runoff for a Portland City Council seat. Ryan will serve until 2022, which is the remainder of the term of City Commissioner Nick Fish, who died in office in January from abdominal cancer. Ryan is the third openly LGBTQ commissioner in Portland's history and will be the first commissioner living with HIV. This will be the first time the City Council has had more than one LGBTQ member at a time. In a statement, Ryan said, quote, "This campaign was about bringing Portlanders together to address the issues we all face. Our city is in crisis, and I am eager to jump in and get to work." Ryan's previous experience includes top fundraising positions at Portland State University and Oregon Ballet Theater, as well as 3 years on the Portland Public School Board. On Tuesday, Native Women in Politics celebrated the announcement of Joe Biden's running mate, Kamala Harris. With that story and more, we go to Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native Women in Politics were among those to celebrate presidential candidate Joe Biden's announcement Tuesday, naming California Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate. Congresswoman Deb Haaland posted a selfie with Harris on social media, adding her support to the Democratic ticket. Peggy Flanagan, Lieutenant Governor of Minnesota, tweeted her congratulations, Flanagan saying she knows a little something about being second in command. And North Dakota state lawmaker Ruth Buffalo posted photos of Harris in attendance at an event with Native women. Buffalo saying on Twitter, she's excited. Women supporting women running for office want to see candidates represent their communities and favor women's issues, says Janie Parrish, campaign director for the Northeast Arizona Native Democrats. She also worked for the political action committee Emily's List, which seeks to get pro-choice Democratic women elected to office.
When we have women supporting women, depending on what party or line, you know, that's a personal choice. But I'm Democratic, I'm pro-choice Democratic, and I will support women candidates in that same value frame. But I also think that it's really important back in our own nuclear families and our homes, and how we already are against a lot. We're already against a lot of challenges, and we don't need to create more of that strife. We need to support one another now more than ever.
As far as Harris's knowledge of Indian country, she touched on Native issues during her run for president last year. Harris appeared by video before a Native vote forum in August 2019, saying she supported the sovereignty of tribes. She has been criticized for her record as a prosecutor as being tough on crime. Her bid for president was endorsed by at least one California tribal chairman, Mark Macaro, who said she engaged California tribes in many roles. Rosebud Sioux tribal members in South Dakota must quarantine for 14 days if they attend the Sturgis motorcycle rally taking place in the state. Tribal Chairman Rodney Bordeaux suggests they not attend this year's rally in the Black Hills.
This virus is still very active and is spreading on our homelands. We must protect our children, our elders, and those most vulnerable to this virus. The Sturgis rally happens every year, so I ask that you not attend this year. It is way too dangerous for our people.
Bordeaux says the mandatory quarantine is for the health and safety of individuals who attend the rally and anyone they may come in contact with. He asked tribal members to follow federal safety guidelines and avoid large crowds. The Oglala Sioux Tribe and Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe are also advising their citizens to stay away from large events and cities considered hotspots for COVID-19. The motorcycle rally, which attracts thousands of people to the state each year, runs through August 16th. Educators across the country are raising concerns about reopening schools during the pandemic as students return to classrooms or begin lessons online. Distance learning is a challenge for many Native students. Sue Pardon, union president for employees at the Bureau of Indian Education, says the BIE needs to step up efforts to assist Native students and their families.
A lot of the reservations are located in rural areas. There's hardly any broadband available to them, the electronic devices. I think the BIE should be providing every single student an electronic device.
The BIE oversees more than 180 schools and was recently criticized for its plans for in-person learning. That prompted concerns from the union about the health and safety of students and staff. The BIE reopening guidelines follow federal COVID-19 safety plans. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Mail sorting machines are being removed from post offices in Iowa, further reducing the agency's ability to do its job as normal. Iowa Postal Workers Union President Kimberly Caro addressed the new Postmaster General, William DeJoy. She says his policies are, quote, now affecting the way that we do business and not allowing us to deliver every piece every day as we've done in the past. Caros went on to say, quote, I see this as a way to undermine the public confidence in the mail service. It's not saving costs. On Monday, Washington Secretary of State Kim Wyman expressed concerns that attempts to cut costs at the U.S. Postal Service could impact the November election. A July 31st letter to Wyman from U.S. Postal Service General Counsel Thomas Marshall warned that changes in post office operations could, quote, create a risk that some ballots will not be returned by mail in time to be counted. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the North Portland Tenants Collective, followed by news from the Boo. That's going to be your look at the news inside KBOO. At 6, we'll hear Right to Survive, then at 7, tune in for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 61 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be expecting sunny skies and a high of 78. Today in history, in 2006, Victoria Gray Adams died. Adams was a civil rights activist and a co-founder of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which she announced would challenge the power of white segregationist politicians. The quote of the day is from Victoria Gray Adams, who said in 1964 that there are two types of people in grassroots politics. She said, quote, those who are in the movement and those who have the movement in them. The movement is in me, and I know it always will be. On Tuesday, Minnesota Representative Ilhan Omar won the Democratic primary, defeating Antone Melton Moe, an attorney and mediator who raised millions to run against her. Omar is a Somali refugee, and in 2018, she became one of the first two Muslim women elected to Congress. Since then, she's been outspoken on liberal issues and in her criticism of President Trump. She tweeted, quote, tonight, our movement didn't just win. We earned a mandate for change. Just a week ago, Omar's fellow quote-unquote squad members, Rashida Tlaib of Michigan and Cori Bush, a Missouri Black Lives Matter activist, won their primaries. On the other side of the political spectrum, in Georgia's Republican-controlled 14th Congressional District, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has expressed racist views and support for QAnon, won yesterday's primary as well. Greene has tens of thousands of followers on social media and has posted videos complaining of a, quote, Islamic invasion of government offices, as well as various other far-right conspiracies. The continuing COVID-19 pandemic forces major changes to the prison education programs around the country. Suzanne Potter has more on the story.
Just like traditional colleges, California's education programs for people in prison have had to make huge changes in the wake of the pandemic, even as Congress decides whether to make permanent the program that sustains them. Robert Rehnquist with Chaffey College in Southern California says his institution has transitioned to a correspondence course model until it's safe to return to in-person learning.
Previously, faculty would go in and teach their classes face-to-face. We also had tutoring centers and computer labs, as well as counselors. And because of the pandemic, we've no longer been able to access the facility for those types of opportunities.
The U.S. House of Representatives voted recently to make the Second Chance Pell program permanent as part of an appropriations bill, but it still needs to go to the Senate and then the president. Multiple California schools work with prisons to offer associate's and bachelor's degrees to incarcerated students, including Cal State LA and Southwestern Community College in San Diego. In April, the Trump administration expanded the Obama-era Second Chance Pell Grant pilot program to invite 67 more schools nationwide to join, including Sacramento State University. Rehnquist says communities benefit when incarcerated people are given the chance to improve their skills and earn a degree.
For every dollar spent in incarcerated education, $5 are saved in other state costs for incarcerating individuals. Without the skills to re-enter, to be a thriving individual, many students will be reoffending when they return to the community.
Over the past few years, more than 12,000 students in prisons nationwide have participated in the Second Chance Pell Grant program. Support for this reporting was provided by the Lumina Foundation. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Pharmacies across the country are becoming safe spaces for domestic violence survivors. And a new initiative is providing pharmacies with more resources meant to open the door for patients to talk about their safety. Mary Sherman has more on that story.
Some of the measures intended to help stop the spread of COVID-19 are making difficult times even more challenging for victims of domestic violence. Stay-at-home orders and social distancing recommendations are believed to be linked to an increase in domestic violence incidents and also are making it more difficult for survivors to seek help. Miriam Shaw Ojeda with the Ohio Pharmacists Association says that's why they are partnering with the Ohio Domestic Violence Network to raise awareness on the role pharmacies can play in increasing safety for domestic violence victims.
We are probably one of the most accessible healthcare providers to all of our patients at this time, and therefore it was a very good opportunity to combine forces with ODVN and try and help patients who are suffering at the moment.
The Ohio Pharmacists Care About Domestic Violence Initiative is providing pharmacies with educational resources for domestic violence victims during the pandemic, including flyers that can be dropped in medication bags with information on accessing housing, food, medical care, and medications. Shaw Ojeda is hopeful the initiative will open the door for patients to talk to their healthcare provider about their safety. She says pharmacists know their patients and want them to have better outcomes.
When someone is struggling with an unsafe environment at home, it does affect their health. It does affect other parts of their lives. And so as pharmacists, we want to make sure that our patients have an overall healthy outlook, not just in relation to their medication.
Shaw Ojeda notes that about 100 Ohio pharmacies have already signed on to the effort, and they are conducting a massive outreach to get even more on board. For Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is trying to remember normal.
The crazier things get, the better and more difficult it is to act normal. August is warm and flowering. Act as if the stores will stay stocked with toilet paper and pasta, as if there will be an election, as if Biden and Harris will win. Also best to take nothing for granted, as these aren't normal times. COVID is ravaging the world, the American empire is crumbling, Trump golfs while our cities suffer, so many starving people, some about to be evicted, so many powerful weapons, mostly in the hands of soldiers and police, and who do they work for? Anything can happen, so stay fluid, present, and joyous. I'm hoping my years of practicing bass and Tai Chi will give me a solid beat to keep moving to and the balance to go any direction at any moment. We all have skills like these, connections, instincts. There are ripe blackberries on unimproved streets and untended lots all over town. Plums will be ripe any day. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Parents are seeking ways to confront uncertainty as schools begin to reopen across the nation. Eric Tegedoff has the story.
Working parents face tough decisions as the school year starts, including who will care for their children while they attend school virtually. Taryn Yates with the Idaho Children's Trust Fund has a 5-year-old entering kindergarten next week in Boise, where schools are holding classes online for at least the first 3 weeks. She's still not sure who will be watching her son and says it's the uncertainty that's most stressful. Yates points out that humans are designed to react to threats in short bursts, not prolonged dangers.
It's just like you're always on guard, and that's actually just having a constantly triggered stress system that really just creates a wear and tear effect on your body over time.
She notes there are many factors contributing to this constant state of stress, including access to safe childcare during the pandemic and the threat from coronavirus itself. Yates says most humans have a negativity bias. Walking in the woods, for instance, if we hear a noise, we assume it's a predator. She says that response was useful thousands of years ago, but doesn't serve modern humans very well. Yates says people can push back against that bias and hack their brains to think more positively, which strengthens an optimism bias.
Well, what if everyone's okay? What's that going to look like? If every single path in front of me, everyone ends up okay? And just really doing these mental exercises with yourself to challenge that negativity bias and calm your brain down.
She says talking to friends and using tactics like journaling can help confront this bias as well. Yates says these are important ways to relieve stress now, but parents will need bigger, more sustainable solutions to stay afloat going forward.
In the long run, it's really going to take investment from our local and state governments and federal governments to prop up people with children so that, you know, we can all thrive.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 12th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and Nat Moon. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, Mary Sherman, and Eric Tegedoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Juneteenth Radio, covering the latest stories happening nationally in African American and Black society. At 9, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, we'll hear Between the Covers, which features interviews with locally and nationally known authors. And finally, at 11:30, tune in for Words and Pictures, featuring an interview with legendary comics journalist Stan Mack. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you would like to support our programming, go to kboo.fm, or you can use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. Thank you.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Much has been said about the impact of coronavirus restrictions on small businesses. The uncertainty has been trying, and many businesses have had to adapt or close entirely. But what about small media organizations? The Portland Mercury has been a fixture of the Portland media scene since 2000, offering a free newspaper with news coverage as well as a robust arts and culture section. I caught up with the editor-in-chief of the Portland Mercury, William Stephen Humphrey, to learn about the history of the Mercury and where they are now.
So, how did your involvement with the Portland Mercury start?
It actually started way back in ye olden times of the grunge era in 1991, where I became a staff member at the Stranger newspaper in Seattle. And we operated there, of course, and it's still in operation. But we did that for 10 years before we decided to come down to Portland and set up shop here. So myself and Rob Crocker, who is our CFO right now, came down to Portland and set up shop, hired people, and we started doing that in the year 2000.
Oh, okay, yeah, so a long time.
Yeah. So what is it now? So it's coming up on, yeah, it's coming, it's our, just, we just celebrated our 20th anniversary in Portland.
So in thinking about that 20 years, what would you say the role of the Mercury has been in, like, the local media market?
I think that the Mercury has been, well, we're an alternative newspaper. So I think our primary job in the Portland market is to be an outlet for progressive journalism. We like really focus on City Hall and cops, and you know, increasingly now COVID and like how that's affecting people. You know, within, whether it's like unemployment or you know sometimes how it affects the prison population right now. So there's a lot of different angles to cover.
Right. And so how has that role changed with COVID-19?
The way COVID has affected us is that we, it all came down, like, around, you would obviously heard about it, like, from, you know, it, starting in different countries. But it really hit, like, around March 13th for us. We were... like the first death had just happened in Seattle at our sister paper, The Stranger. And so almost immediately when the governor shut down of Washington, shut down like all the large gatherings, that's when like all the advertising in The Stranger stopped, because all of our advertising comes from restaurants, venues, places like that, right? So we knew that was going to happen here. It was just only a matter of time. So that's when, on March 13th, we ended up laying off half of our staff. And I'm sorry, I still get a little bit emotional about it, because these were my very good friends and not just employees to me. But it was a really hard time, and it continues to be a really hard time for us. And weirdly enough, it's been 5 months since March 13th, and we're still here, shockingly. And I think a lot of the there's like two big reasons that I think we're still here. And one is diversification, where we were able to pivot and start doing different things to still make money. And the second thing is readers' monthly contributions. I was like insanely shocked, because when like we started asking for these contributions from our readers and they actually ponied up, I was just absolutely thrilled and surprised. And I don't know why I should have been. I think it's just like I've always felt like it, you know, that we didn't never wanted to ask for that. You know, I guess maybe it was a little bit of pride or whatever. We didn't want to ask for that, but we ended up doing it, and it was like we were just like so shocked and honored by the support we got from our readers, and they've been keeping us afloat. So many have been giving these monthly contributions, and you know, now we're actually kind of making it. And you know, like, we don't know what's going to come around the corner, so we just have to remain super flexible. And you know, but we actually do see a pathway out of here, and hopefully you know, we'll be able to, you know, push through to next year, and then we'll see what happens.
I have a conjecture, which is that I think that there's like a level of cultural knowledge that newspapers generally have been suffering financially from, you know, a downtick in advertising and having to look for new models of revenue.
That's
but
true.
The Mercury isn't just like news oriented. There's also the whole arts and culture aspect. And I wonder if you think that that has allowed that type of, you know, advertising support to last longer than perhaps like mainstream newspapers.
Yeah, I do. I mean, the Mercury has been supported, you know, by like our advertisers for, you know, the last 20 years, like largely on restaurants, music clubs, arts venues, and stuff like that. So yeah, they're definitely the ones who have kept us afloat for so long. And you know, we had our advertising rates were, and they still are, pretty very reasonable, because we just feel like, especially the arts community, that's kind of what makes Portland Portland. It's interesting and it's vibrant, and it makes people want to move here. People want to move to places where there's like a vibrant community. So for sure, you know, I think the arts and food community and the music community have like kept us afloat for so many years. And yeah, and so when that was like taken away, you know, by COVID, and it won't be gone forever. You know, it's going to come back. And so all, you know, we have to do is just kind of hang on and until it does come back.
Right. And it sounds like you've been able to do that, even if now, you know, instead of offering a free paper, some folks are paying a monthly subscription to support you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we don't really call it a subscription. I mean, you can. It's fine. we mostly just ask it for, like, monthly contributions, because it's really amazing. Because we've made a lot of choices that, you know, are pretty unusual, that would be, like, just thinking a year ago, it just would be mind-boggling to even think about what we're doing now. It's like, one, not printing a paper anymore, because the paper prices are always, like, one of our biggest expenses as a company. And since we're not publishing a paper right now, we may be doing it again. We'll just have to wait and see, like, if the advertising base comes back. Getting rid of the print product, and we just recently got rid of our office. We've moved out of that, and we'll probably be getting another office at some point. But we just can't see using our reader contributions for like an office that we don't use, right? Or like, that's the same reason we like took our boxes like off the street, because mostly they're just receptacles for dog poo right now, which is completely okay with me. I was fine with people putting their dog poo in the Mercury boxes, better that than on the street. But it was, you know, hard to kind of maintain those boxes and keep them looking okay. So we're just like taking them off the street and putting them into storage. So we're like making money in a lot of different ways. We do, besides advertising that we're still getting, because we're trying to still help out like advertisers and small businesses that are really struggling right now. And they need the people who are open, they really need to let people know that they're open. And so there's the web advertising that we're doing. We've got our streaming stuff, which is a lot of fun. Like we stream the Hump Festival now online. We have the Cough Festival. We have the I Anonymous show streaming that. We have this new film festival coming up called Slay, which is 5 minute. It's like Hump, except for horror movies. And so people can send in their 5 minute horror movies. So we're streaming that and charging for that. And that's a lot of fun. And we're doing Mercury t-shirts too. And we've got one right now by a local artist named Sloan Leong, who is fantastic. And it's this great resist t-shirt. And so you can find that on the Mercury site if you want. But yeah, we're like doing a lot of different things to make money these days.
Yeah, so as much as COVID has kind of, I don't know, kneecapped the prior model, it's forcing innovation too.
Right, exactly. And we've always been pretty nimble and flexible, you know, but this is, I'll tell you, this is pushing us. And we have to, you know, we used to have to like have these 6 month to a year plan. Now we're having week to week plans, you know, because things change that quickly.
In making this transition, have you encountered folks that have, you know, misconceptions about making that change or what the Mercury is looking like or where they're going to end up?
I think people, the misconceptions are pretty small. I mean, I think that, the proof is in the pudding and we're still here. So, I mean, I think people will say like, oh, you know, that you're not printing the paper anymore, therefore the Mercury does not exist. We've always, you know, we've existed since like 2008 online. And in fact, now, like, our readership online has gone huge. I think we're like 300% over what we were last year. And that's, you know, largely due to just like great, great reporting, especially, you know, from our news department, Alex Zielinski and Blair Stenvik, who are the best goddamn news team in town. I'll tell you that right now. I may be a little bit biased about that. So basically, people, there's been like some of that stuff that has been gone around. But I think for like, I would say this overwhelmingly, we've gotten just huge support from Portland, and just like, everyone has just been sweet as pie to us, I would say. A lot more than maybe they used to be. I think you used to just like hear like a lot of, like most, when people are mad, when people are happy, they don't write in. And when people are mad, they write in a lot. So that's what you would hear. But nowadays it's, I think because of COVID and just the situation that we're all in, they've been showing us a lot of support.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything we didn't cover?
No, I mean, I would just like really, we just want everybody to know that we're, like it's a super hard time, and it's a super hard time for everybody. And I just kind of want everybody to know that the Mercury is here and we're still in your corner. And we hope that you're just like as determined and hopeful as we are that we're going to be able to push through this, and that there's going to be some real systemic changes that comes out of all of this.
That was my conversation with William Stephen Humphrey. He's the editor-in-chief of the Portland Mercury. They can be found online at portlandmercury.com. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
At KBOO, we think that all communities deserve to be fully informed on the policies and decisions that will impact their lives, and we need your help to make that happen. We're looking for citizen journalists to help collect, report, and broadcast the news. Do you think that there are groups that are underrepresented or marginalized by the mainstream media? Are you aware of social, political, or environmental activities that don't have adequate visibility? Are there important issues in your town or region that aren't getting coverage? This is your chance to give a voice to the voiceless. You don't have to have experience, and you don't have to come into KBOO's Portland studio. You can contribute from wherever you live. If you have some basic writing skills and a desire to get the word out, we want you. Just send an email with your idea and contact information to newsdirector, that's all one word, newsdirector@kboo.fm, and include the words citizen journalist in the subject line, and the news team will contact you. Once again, send that email to newsdirector@kboo.fm.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
Well, good evening. You are listening to News from the Boo here on KBOO Community Radio. That's right. We are volunteer-powered and supported by you, the community. I'm Jenny Yokoyama, your host, and also one of your interim station co-managers. And here on News from the Boo, we talk about everything KBOO, everything going on inside, outside, around KBOO. It's a show for our listeners, our volunteers, our members, anybody who's a fan of KBOO. So how you all doing today? I will say I'm enjoying the a little bit cooler weather. I know it's going to be heating up again, but I'm enjoying the cooler weather. Kind of, you know, take the